you'll just be blown out of the auditorium. Welcome back. This is week four of our study of Romans. We will be doing chapter five and a little review. But before we do that, Jeff is going to lead us in an opening prayer. Thank you. Picking up a little bit of review there, the thesis statement, as we've said several times in Romans, Paul stated this in 1:17 or 16 and 17, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith." We are, as we were looking at last week, we are justified by faith. Works of law, observances and such have no real power. We cannot be saved by such things. People have tried so many ways without success. The only way that works is through the righteousness of God that he reveals in the gospel. We saw that Abraham was set up as an example of living by faith and justification through faith. And this was so significant because Abraham is so important to the Jews. They would always say, well, we have Abraham as our father. But Abraham was attested to having been justified by faith 15 years or so before he received circumcision, and over 400 years before the law. So these things of circumcision and the law weren't important in that sense. Circumcision was given as a seal of the covenant that had already been made, and the law was just a caretaker, a teacher to keep us along the way. Chapter 4 ends with this statement. "Now, not for his sake only was it written that it was credited to him, but for our sake also, to whom it will be credited, as those who believe in him who raised Jesus our Lord from the dead, he who was delivered over because of our transgressions and was raised because of our justification." Now, just a thought here. When we're reading Romans, this book is incredibly dense. You can read it and read it many times, and if you just read through it, you're not going to get it. I mean, this is something that, at least in my opinion, you really have to slow down, look at each phrase separately, try to keep the big picture, but how does each one of these things come in? Because Paul's not just throwing in flowery phrases. Every one of these things has meaning. So take your time. As a sort of analogy, you can travel around in a car without really understanding it. So you can sort of live a Christian life without understanding how its foundations are put together and such. But if you really want to explain how a car works, you've got to know all those parts and systems and how they interact. And this is kind of what Paul's doing here, is he's laying the foundations of Christianity, how the structure is. And so if we really want to understand at that level, you really got to take time and study it. Unfortunately, we don't have that much time in one quarter, so we're going to have to move through some of this fairly quickly. So on to chapter 5. Begins with, "Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have obtained our introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we exult in hope of the glory of God. A few comments on here. Of course, you have therefore, and the preacher thing is, if you see therefore, what's it there for? It's to link to the previous discussion. And he had just laid out how we are justified by faith. So now, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God. We have. That is present tense continuing. This is an ongoing thing. We have been justified. That was a past tense thing. That is, if having put on Christ, we have been justified. But now we have peace with God, and we continue in this peace with God. Instead of saying introduction by faith, some say access to faith, access by faith into grace. Different translations put that a little bit differently, and it might put a little different coloring on the way you understand it. If you were to say access, that carries the sense perhaps of a door, the opening, the way that you get there. So I am the door. That works. The introduction to faith, or introduction by faith, you have the sense of Jesus taking you along with him and introducing you to his Father, saying, I'd like you to meet, that sort of thing. But it is through faith that all of this happens. We get down to, into this grace in which we stand. Some people have taken this thing and say, we stand, and we stand forever, and try to turn this into the once saved, always saved kind of thing, just out of this one line here. But that's in contradiction to places where Paul talked about those who had fallen from grace, and he even referred to himself saying that he disciplined his body so that he would not be disqualified after having preached so much to others. So this idea of that some would try to say we stand and it's a permanent thing, like the Calvinist, what's the right term there? Perseverance of the saints, the pea and the tulip. That's not what's being taught. The peace with God is a fact. It's not a feeling. Now, we may have an emotional kind of response to that, but that is not the real statement here. We have peace because of what was done, not because we feel good or are happy one day. To concentrate on that word, in the Hebrew, they use shalom. And this little excerpt, which is being cut off there at the bottom, almost, from the Complete Jewish Bible, defines shalom, the word, as peace, tranquility, safety, welfare, well-being, contentment, health, success. And it was often used as a greeting. People would say shalom or shalom aleichem, for peace be on you, peace be with you. This gives you kind of the sense of how in 1 John, John said, little children, abide in him. That abiding has a sense of being at home. Just settle in. That's where you belong. Be at home with him. James talked about being double-minded. Do not be double-minded. Don't say, well, I'm here, but, this being tossed back and forth. Be at home. So, a little discussion. What does having peace with God mean to you personally?
Favor because of what we believe and the
anybody else? He's saying that the comfort of knowing that he's in a good relationship with God, it gives a sense of peace. I know that many here were raised in the church. For those of us that were not and spent many decades out there wandering around in darkness, coming in and finally getting out of that mess is just extraordinary. That's my bit. Derek. This bottom line here that's in bold, and we exult in hope of the glory of God. What is exult? It is an overflowing joy. The more you dwell on this and let this sink in and consider the love of God and what he has done and this peace that we have with him, the more this joy just overwhelms. Other translations, I forget what they say, but basically the same idea. We are bubbling over with joy. New King James says, we rejoice. The Complete Jewish Bible, which is more of a, it's more on the spectrum toward the paraphrase as opposed to the literal translation, but expands it a bit. So let us boast about the hope of experiencing God's glory. Now, it's not crystal clear whether we're talking about this sense of in God's glory or sharing his glory, but it doesn't make a lot of difference. And not only that. Now, Paul uses a lot of these connective phrases, but as I said earlier, it's not just words that are thrown in there. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Isn't that kind of weird? I mean, tribulations, we exult, we glory in tribulations. You think, oh, times are bad. You know, I'm having a rough patch here. I'm happy. Oh, really? Yes, Karen. She's saying that you have the peace of knowing that God is in control. He has your back, so to speak. Neil. What happens if there's no adversity? No growth. Have you ever seen, well, if you don't exercise, do you get stronger? No. You get stagnant. A couple of illustrations. You see trees that have grown in the forest. For example, a whole bunch of pines growing up close together. They grow really tall and very thin. And if you were to cut away those other trees, sometimes this happens where they'll take a road project through and they cut through a stand of trees. And so now you've got all these trees that were used to being protected by the other ones are now exposed. In the next big windstorm, you see a whole bunch of them get snapped off. They had not grown strong by being exposed to the wind. A tree that grows by itself out there may not grow as tall, but it's going to be strong because it bears the full brunt of the wind, and it reacts to that. It gets strong. Within our own bodies, bones are continually being rebuilt, remodeled, as they say. They're being taken apart inside and being reformed all the time. So if your bones are being stressed, they get stronger. If they're not stressed, the body is conservative of these resources and puts them somewhere else. Same kind of thing spiritually. If we have struggles, if we are being pushed and tested, we're going to get stronger. But if we hide away back there, you know, and don't do anything, don't say, yes, I'll do something, then no growth. Why is it that hope doesn't disappoint us? Says hope doesn't disappoint us. We build this hope. Exactly. God keeps his promises. If we are hoping in him, we will not be disappointed. Period. Now, there are times when something in me is saying, oh, this is all just a lie. You know, the doubts that creep in there. But then something in there is still saying, no, it's the truth. Trust him. Now, we come to a part that I remember reading many, many, many times. I never got it. It just seemed like a strange phrasing. Paul uses just a couple lines here to convey something really important, so we're going to spend some time on it. Here's the question. Who would you die for? We'll just run through a few options. A righteous person, somebody who's just good, upstanding citizen. I don't see hands going up yet. A good person, somebody who's a good, upstanding citizen and happened to be really nice to people. Not an overwhelming response here either. Your best friend? How about your spouse? Your child? Okay, now going through this series, what do you observe about your willingness to sacrifice for somebody else? It takes a lot of love. As we go down this list, it goes from somebody who's just kind of out there, perhaps very worthy, but as they become closer and closer, dearer and dearer to you, your willingness goes up. So we have this expression everyone's familiar with, dearer than life itself, and that's the question we're really asking here. Dearer than life itself. Somebody has to be extremely dear to you for you to say, I would give my life for them. Let's try going a little bit down the other direction. Would you die for somebody who snubs you? Is too good for you? Doesn't want to be associated with you? I don't see any hands. How about somebody who slanders you? Is telling other people untruths? How about someone who's spiteful and vicious and wants to kill you? Not seeing any hands here. We had just established that to die for someone, they've got to be extremely dear to you. That aspect of human nature, that willingness to sacrifice, gives us just a little glimpse into God's nature. As we come into, yes. Yeah. As we go through this, this now sets this. This gets us back to the text. For while we were still helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. That was all of us, as is just pointing out. For one will hardly die for a righteous man. We didn't actually see any hands go up for that one. Though perhaps for the good man, someone would dare even to die. And we actually got a lot closer than just the good man out there. But God demonstrates his own love for us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's us, but that's also everyone. We tend to look at ourselves and say, well, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad. I'm not sure. But this gives us a glimpse into God's love. We went through a hypothetical For Jesus, it was not hypothetical. He did die for those whom he held dearer than life itself. He died for those that were lost and alone. He died for the Pharisees who just looked good on the outside, but inside were full of uncleanness. He died even for those who revel in sin, who applaud it, and look for new ways to become more and more vile. He died for the crowd that was yelling, "Crucify him, crucify him," for no other reason than everybody else was doing it, and it might provide them some entertainment for a little while. Surely some of them just got caught up in the moment. Yeah, this is fun. Life was cheap. He died for those who beat him and mocked him. He even died for those who killed him. And such were some of us. Think about what this means. That God holds every sinner that dear. Every last one that dear. That he was willing to give his son, that Jesus was willing to die for every last one, no matter how far out, how nasty. That's God's love for us. That is the so loved in John 3:16. We sing the song, "Oh, what love, matchless love." Truly. Thinking about this, I thought, we've heard and read these things so many times, we tend to just kind of go over it. We say the words and it's not really getting in there. We tend to become accustomed to it, kind of spoiled. We've had this goodness so much for so long, it's just everyday life to us. And don't stop and think about how important it is. But Paul goes on. Much more than. Again, this is one of these transition phrases, but it's not just filler. Much more than. Having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. For if while we were enemies, in that previous state, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. You ever have those doubts of, I know what the gospel says and it's for everybody, but I'm different. I've got this thing that, I'm going to be tossed out in the end somehow. I just know it. Do you hear that sometimes? This says, don't listen to it. Much more. God put so much investment in us through Jesus, so much to save us, that he's not going to throw us away. He's got your back. You could say it 100 other ways, but we are that dear to him, he is not going to throw us out. Then again, and not only this, as if this wasn't enough already, but we also exult in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have received the reconciliation. Again, this exulting, this joy, I mean, you cannot resist it. If you if you focus on this and look at the blessings that God has given us, what he has done for us, how much he loves us, you can't help it. The thought came to mind, this is kind of like the modern game show where the host is saying, you won this, and while they're getting all happy, and this. And this is how Paul is doing it. There's this much, and there's this much more. How can you not be overwhelmed by that love? Okay, we'll calm down a little bit. And just look at this. Fruits of justification. We have all these things as a result of the justification. We have reconciliation with God. We have access to the grace. We have peace with God. We have the hope of the glory of God. We have joy in tribulation. An assurance of salvation. All of these promises, all of this flows through the justification. Any comments? Okay, coming to the second half. This is one of the most debated passages in all of the Bible. Commentary said that amongst scholars, every word, in fact, every punctuation mark is debated in this passage. Exactly how should this be understood and interpreted? It's not easy. And in fact, with Paul's style, he starts out in verse 12 and just kind of stops. He doesn't finish the sentence, doesn't finish the thought until about verse 18 when he picks it up again. And there's this big part that goes in between. He's drawing comparisons to compare and contrast Adam and Jesus. You have Adam, through whom sin entered the world, and death spread to all through that. And then you have Christ, whose one act of obedience brought reconciliation and life. John Chrysostom, who is 300-something to 407, I believe, approximately, suggested that what Paul was doing in here was answering another one of these questions that the Jews would have raised. You've got this thing. How can one act by one man redeem the entire world? That seems like you've got all this sin, and the one thing is supposed to take care of it. Well, he drew the parallel that through Adam, sin entered the world. The Jews were very familiar with this, and they had no argument with it. That one act of disobedience in the garden brought sin and death into the world. And so he's saying, by the same token, you know, it should not surprise you, therefore, that this one act of obedience that Jesus did, the perfect obedience, could have this effect, the overwhelming effect to erase or to counter, to pay for, to be the propitiation for all of that sin. So this was, again, in that context, if you think of it as the probable question that the Jews would raise, how could this be that you have this one act that was effective for all of this? He's saying, you believe this, you accept it from Adam, accept it through Christ. Begins with therefore again. Therefore what? Well, attaching to something to something that went before. Now, some people say it might be the previous verse or a little bit of the previous chapter, or even the entire book up to this point, because he had laid out condemnation and justification. And now is showing how, where condemnation came from, and also where justification comes from. We can put this in sort of a table form, where we have Adam was disobedient, you know, a little comparison and contrast. Adam was disobedient, Jesus was obedient. The act of disobedience brought sin and death. The act of obedience brought reconciliation and life. Sin entered and spread to all through Adam. Through Christ, the gift of righteousness was made available to all. We have condemnation and death came through Adam, justification of life through Jesus. Then the law entered so that the offense might abound. The law just shone the light on things to say, this is what's right and this is you. Paul later says, I wouldn't have known what coveting was if the law hadn't said, don't covet. But grace abounded much more. Even when all of this sin grows, grace is still way, way, way beyond it. Far, far and away sufficient to handle, to account for it. So we have this way that Paul says sin reigned in death. That gives you the sense of sin as this taskmaster, and he says, you're going to die. But we're set free from that one through grace. That grace then reigns through righteousness to eternal life. We have a few minutes left for some discussion. We now stand in grace, having been reconciled with God through his Son, and we are his children. John 1, 12 and 13, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And then 1 John 3, 1 and 2. See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us, that we would be called children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, we are children of God, and it has not appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him just as he is. So we're his children. You've got the family business. And as you grow up in the family and you begin to work in the family business, what does this mean for us? What does all this that we've discussed mean for us in the way that we behave? That's an open question. well said. I wish that we had the microphone on you. If we are going to be like him, we need to be doing what he does, loving everyone with the same love that he has, holding every last person in this world that dear, that they need to hear the gospel, they need to have the opportunity for reconciliation. Every last one of them. So Dottie kind of took away some of the stuff that I was going to add here, but just a couple of scriptures to follow up on that. Matthew 5, 44 through 48. Would someone like to read that? Somebody with a big voice? I've been doing all the reading so far. Matthew 5, 44 through 48. That you may be sons of your Father. That's the illustration of what we were just talking about, that we can't just do what's comfortable. Be like the Gentiles, which most of us are. But to love everyone. Another one, Luke 6, 35 and 36. Luke 6, verses 35 and 36. 36.
But love your enemies and do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. You will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind.
So, next week, chapter 6 and 7, which means we're going to have to move pretty fast through it. But just one little thought for consideration. When we talk about loving our enemies, do I have enemies? Who might that be, if there are any? And what will it mean to me to love them? Thanks for your attention.
Down that list.